Wow, thank you guys so much. That was just a great overview of all the different variety of ways we can diagnose patients with dry eye. And now we get to the fun part, which is how we treat patients with dry eye. Let's start with Dr. Nichols. You know, there's so many different different ways we can treat patients. Let's talk about your patient comes in, they only have had artificial tears. What's your kind of your first line treatment for patients? And if you want to separate evaporative versus aqueous efficient, that's perfectly fine too.
I'm going to take a tiny little step back before that, though. I think it really depends on how they come into you, where they are in the dry eye sort of road. Because they may get to like a practice where, you know, especially practice and they've never seen anybody before. Like they think that they have dry eye, they've heard something on TV, they've gone to the market by the, you know, found something on their own. But then there's also people who have this long history. And so they may look like they've not tried anything, but they've tried a lot, maybe not a lot for a long time, like they've never stayed on anything consistently. So it really does depend on how they're coming to you, where you start. So if they're like a naive to everything, they're usually not, because they've tried something on their own, like artificial tears. And so your next step should be in a process so that you can follow a process with your patients, depending on what type of dry they might have, whether you think it's aqueous deficient or it's evaporative or some combination of both. And if it's one or the other, you're going to lean towards some different treatments, especially if you think there's a lot of inflammation there or not, or how bad their meibomian glands might look. So what you don't want to do is like what I call a kitchen sink it all at one time, where you're just throwing everything in at once. So you should start with what you think is the most predominant factor of their dry eye, or the, you know, finding of their dry, and go from there. But I don't know that there's a simple answer to that, because they all come to you different, you know, from their history and what they've tried before. Finding out what they failed is really important to success, I think, in a new setting.
Okay, no, those are great points. And I totally appreciate exactly what you're saying, because this is a difficult question, for time reason, we'll just try to make sure everyone gets some thoughts here. Just that first patient, Dr. Brimer, when you see a patient, and I'm going to set the stage. So as Dr. Nichols shared, there's not just one type of patient, but let's imagine you have a patient that has their contact lens where they've used artificial tears, and now they're coming to see you because they're having contact lens intolerance. What's your typical first line of treatments for these type of patients?
I want to look at the underlying cause of what's creating the dryness. So if it's the contact lens patient, I'm going to look at the material. I'm going to look at how they clean them. Is it daily disposable? That sort of thing. But I'm just not the person that typically recommends tears much at all. And fine if it's an occasional dry eye and it's situational dry eye, I want them to use preservative-free tears. But most of the time, and again, my perspective's different because they're coming to me more advanced. So we got to throw that out there. But most of the time, they've gotten where they are because they've been using tears chronically for years, and it's progressed because they've pacified the emergent need by putting tears on it. So they made it through another day and another day, but meanwhile, things were getting worse. So I tell patients, I'm not going to stop you on your tears. You can keep using them for now, but my goal is to figure out what's going on so that you don't need them anymore. And when you come back to me and you say, oh, I'm just using tears, you know, once or twice a week, then we know we're where we need to be. So I'm not going to change the tears. I am going to look at the material. I'm going to look at what their modality is, how they're cleaning them. But primarily, I'm going to take those contacts off and say, what else is going on here that we need to address more at the root cause?
Okay, no, those are a beautiful way of approaching that type of patient. You're absolutely right. So let me just ask Dr. Matosi then about artificial tears in general. What are your thoughts on artificial tears in general? Are there some challenges with them? Are you happy with them? And how often do you, as Dr. Brimer suggested that she doesn't stop tears, but maybe tears aren't always the answer. So just curious of your thoughts on tears.
You know, Bill, there are challenges with artificial tears. The first one is if we as eye care providers don't take the time to look at what's going on and instead just very, you know, rapidly or superficially say, oh, Mr. Jones or Mrs. Jones, just use some artificial tears. We are not doing the patient the service that they deserve. We need to dig and figure out the cause and appropriately treat. Just throwing tears just to kind of mollify the patient is not ideal. Secondly, if we don't specifically recommend a type of tear, we're also doing that patient a disservice. Have you recently checked the shelves in the grocery store or the drugstore in the eye section? It's row after row after row of different types of artificial tears. So somebody who is not an expert in the field, how are they to choose? They don't know. So they go either A, the cheapest, one B that's on sale, or thirdly, they buy something completely wrong, like an anti-allergy drop to get the red out because their eyes are red due to DED, not from allergies, or they get an eye whitener. So this then further exacerbates the dry eye condition. So these are the challenges. We need to A, help our patients by digging deeper, to specifically recommend certain types. And lastly, like Crystal said, preservative-free artificial tears are the way to go. These are people who are already suffering. They're in your offices for a reason. And the preservatives in tears can make the situation worse.
Well, those are such great points. I totally agree with you. So now that you've pointed all those issues out and ways of approaching artificial tears, I'm going to go back to Dr. Brimer and ask the next question, which is, okay, so they've exhausted artificial tears, they've used them, and it just, they're not doing anything. So now you're ready to use an anti-inflammatory agent. I guess the question is, when do you make that decision? When do you decide, okay, now it's time to add an anti-inflammatory agent into the therapy for dry eye disease?
Two situations. So if a patient comes to me and it is very obvious they are on fire, you know, their eyes red, their lid margins are thick and hyperemic, there's a lot of telangiectasia, there's just chronic inflammation. And especially if the patient's in a lot of pain, I know that a lot of the other things I'm about to ask them to do are going to involve delayed gratification. And so if I go ahead and give them a steroid to kind of quench the fire at the moment, it's going to help them stay on course and stay on track to do what I'm asking them to do, because they're going to get some relief early on. Now, when I do that, honestly, I like to use a steroid ointment because I'm asking them to do other things. And that way it's only a once a day dosing and it kills two birds with one stone because it gives them that nighttime lubrication. And I'm not doing refills. I'm just trying to get them over this hump so they can feel a little relief while the other stuff is kicking in. The other times that I'll do it is more when we're along the journey and there's a flare. So I don't think that was really your question, but I threw it in there. And typically this is always, I'm going to implement more in-office procedures than I am going to be a chronic drug. So I use chronic anti-inflammatories, but I'm more likely to do a quick steroid to put out the fire, do in-office procedures to get to the root cause. And then if I need that ongoing anti-inflammatory, then I'll incorporate that.
Okay, beautiful. And I totally agree. I mean, you made some great points on how we can use steroids so effectively for our dry eye patients in different scenarios. Maybe we should just talk about in general, just all the, I guess, various anti-inflammatory technologies that we have available to us. I'm gonna ask Dr. Nichols, because, you know, we have a few different options. We have cyclosporine, we have lefitograst, we have obviously topical steroids, and I can never pronounce this right. I always worry if I pronounce it wrong, but you know, Tyrvaya or Varen Cycline, if I said that right. As everyone knows here, I'm not the best at pronouncing names. Dr. Nichols, maybe share kind of how these anti-inflammatory treatments are similar or different, and how, you know, just a, I guess, an overview of those products.
Great. And I will have a question for all the panelists too at the end, but because if you don't, we'll be thinking. So if you don't have the ability or you haven't done in-office procedures, then your approach might be different relative to some of these other therapies that Bill just mentioned. So, you know, it is interesting depending on where you are. Like, I know if you have, I know what I would do if I had everything in my office versus if you only have, you know, yourself and your slit lamp. So having said that, you know, inflammation is the result of, it's one of the body's ways in which it can respond to insult or injury and or irritation. And so you're going to have inflammation with ocular surface conditions regardless. In some cases, it's not going to be obvious. And in others, it's going to be much more obvious. And in some instances, there's going to be associated factors where they have inflammatory diseases that go along with what you're seeing on the ocular surface. So your choices may be different depending on what else is going on. We have cyclosporin been around for the longest of all of these medications. It had like at least a 15-year head start on lifitegrast. So we tried it, we used it, it was all that was available. And originally when cyclosporin came out, I think a lot of doctors saved it for the worst dry eye patients because they really didn't know how it fit into the algorithm and what they should do. And then there were a number of doctors actually who tried it for a short period of time or patients, and then the patients stopped for whatever reason. They didn't get the full effect, or maybe they didn't realize they got some effect, and so they quit. When we are seeing patients for dry eye clinical trials now, most of the time they've tried cyclosporin at some point in the past. But when they describe how they tried it, it can be like they say, well, I did try it. Well, how long did you try it? Well, I don't know. You know, you ask them if they refilled their prescription to find out if they really tried it. And most of the time they don't. And I would say that's even sort of true with lifitegrast, especially if the patient has symptoms of the negative side effects, you know, whether they have blurry vision, or with cyclosporin, if they have a lot of stinging. Now, there are ways that you can coach a patient around those if you really do feel like having a chronic anti-inflammatory therapy works. And they do. They just do take some time to kick in based on their mechanism of action. They're all slightly different. Then, of course, we talked about steroids just a moment ago, which give you that first, you know, that initial burst, acute help. And then there's, I'll just call it Tyrvaya as well, because Bill, I'm with you. I'm in the camp of can't pronounce any of the new names. There's a few that were just approved we'll talk about later. And I'm like, wait a minute, how do you say that? What are we going to do? So I don't know that I'd put that in the controlling inflammation category, because it is sort of like an internal self-regulated artificial tear that your own body makes. So I guess it can help calm any inflammation on the ocular surface because it's helping to sort of give some lubrication, perhaps, that might have been what was part of the problem, you know, in terms of causing inflammation. But you do have to get to the root of it. And these can all help in their own ways, but they don't solve the problem in most cases. Sorry to be about that, but...
Yeah. That was beautiful. And that was a great overview, which is actually was love to hear, because I think it really helped us kind of set the framework for everything. I think, you know, obviously the two main categories, you know, cyclosporin and lifitegrast, we've had them both now for a little while, even though cyclosporin was first. I mean, I asked Dr. Matosian, maybe if she could explain, you know, the mechanism of lifitegrast and just give an overall view. Because I think even though it's newer and it's been around for a bit, I think people still, it's always helpful to kind of review that.
Well, I will try to make it as simple as I can, but it is complex. In essence, Xiidra or lifitegrast blocks LFA1. So what is LFA1? LFA1 is a surface protein found on the surface of T cells. So T cells are just floating about regularly looking for kind of to be invited to an inflammatory site. When the surface is stressed, there's something called ICAM1s that are overexpressed. ICAM1s invite or recruit T cells. The way a T cell docks onto the ICAM1 is by its LFA1. So it's kind of how they kind of come together. So lifitegrast blocks that ability of the LFA1 to dock with the ICAM1. And it's only through the docking that the T cell is then activated. And then it releases all the pro-inflammatory cytokines and more recruitment of T cells happens. So by blocking it, not only inactive T cells, but active T cells as well, it kind of reduces that perpetual inflammatory cycle on the surface of the eye.
That's a beautiful explanation. That was fantastic. I definitely could not have explained it as concisely as you did, Dr. Matosian. That was beautiful. We all realize, I think all of us, you know, enjoy being able to use the lifitegrast or Xiidra. And I'll ask Dr. Brimer, you know, how do you decide? So your patients come in and, you know, there's a cost to using medications, and also you don't want to over-medicate. How do you decide when to use lifitegrast versus cyclosporin when you're going to add one or the other? What is the key how do you decide between the two?
I feel like that's such a biased answer I'm going to give you. You know, I mean, in my clinic, I have my favorite. I have my tier. I feel like absorption is important. You know, you see all the newer molecules coming out with smaller size molecules and ways to protect it to get through the aqueous so that it absorbs in the tissue better. But ultimately, I think a large factor is going to be patient tolerability. And I had a patient today, and I hardly ever do this, but I broke down and did it. And I gave them samples of each because everything I've ever given him is like, no. And I said, listen, take 5 days with this, take 5 days with that, call me back. Because it wasn't, I said, don't expect a difference in how you feel. I just want to know what you can tolerate. So at this point, I'm grateful to have options because none of these three, and even the ones to come, are going to be perfect for every patient. And yes, we care about efficacy and we want to get the most efficacy as quickly as we possibly can. But if they're not compliant, we're not going to get anything. And so everybody is going to have a different response on what side effects they have and what side effects they can tolerate. So does it burn? Does it give blurred vision? Is there a bad taste? Yada, yada. And so that's one of the factors. One of the factors is cost. And I no longer can predict anything when it comes to that. But I do know that a couple of the companies have patient assist programs. And I appreciate that when they're able to come to the table and help my patients that can't afford it.
Absolutely. Those are great comments. And I agree. It can be a challenge at times. I'll just briefly ask Dr. Nichols and then Dr. Matossian just for this particular question, like how do you decide between the two? Because they are two good options. They both have really nice effects, but just curious, let's go with Dr. Nichols, like how you kind of figure out what to use first.
Yeah, we're in a teaching institution, so we keep that in mind as well. I mean, you know, we allow for our students to select which they're going to try on a patient. And so that they can experience that while they're in school. And so I guess I used to have a preference and now I just sort of like to see where it goes with, you know, overseeing patients because the cost issue, we have a clientele at the school, which isn't necessarily well off. And so the patient assistance programs are good. Medicaid reimbursement for some of them are really, really helpful for patients. So while I might've, you know, and, you know, certainly now there's generic, which can be helpful, with cyclosporine. And so I do think that there are some options to be thinking about that I would hate to say, you know, yeah, I think about cost because you never know what a patient is willing to pay for and what they're not. But yet giving them good options is critical and allowing them to try and see what side effect profile they have is also important because they have to stay on it in order to see an effect.
Right. Great. No, great points. Dr. Matossian, your thoughts on the two options?
You know, I wish I could say we were in control of what drug our patients received. Just because we're prescribing it does not mean that that is the medication the patient is ending up with. Unfortunately, many switch outs happen at the level of the pharmacy because of the insurance program that the patient has, maybe because of the amount of copay difference. So there are so many different factors that go into how a patient ends up with a particular drug that I can no longer predict if I write for A, do they get B? Do they actually get A? Or is it switched out? So I'm happy if they end up with an immunomodulator when warranted.
Perfect. That's a great answer. It's so true. I find the same thing. I'll write one and then I hear from my tech, oh, I'm sorry. That one was the first line on their list of drugs, and you have to go to this one now, unless they had failed this one. You know, it's kind of can be a challenge at times. But I guess the point is that we have these great options, and our patients do have options. If one doesn't work, they can switch to the other, and vice versa.